Hello, everyone, and welcome back to my off-season podcast. I'm your host, Taryn Armstrong, and this week I wanted to do something that coordinated a little bit with some of my other projects. The Big Brother 4 blockumentary final episode, final part, is being released at the end of this week. And so in honor of that, I wanted to do something that ties into it a little bit, because Big Brother 4 is known for the season of the exes. It's known for, players getting ejected. It's known for Allie. But it's also known for being the origin of floating the strategy. Now, if you've been listening to these podcasts, you've probably heard me talk about the term floating and what it means and how you operate as a floater in the Big Brother game. But this podcast is going to be all about floating, the concept, the style, the players, the definition, where it came from, what it actually means. What's the difference between a floater and a coaster, which has been another term that people have tried to get to catch on. All of those questions and more will be answered in this podcast. So please stick around. Who's leaving a podcast? Did you listen to a minute of this podcast and decide, you know what? Screw this. Floating. Ugh. Hopefully you didn't. Hopefully you didn't, because I think that there's some content in this podcast that you may not have known. Even if you think you know, you might be like, ah, yeah, I'm in the know. I know what a floater is. I know where it came from. I know how it changed. These plebs who talk about floaters grab a life vest, they don't know what they're talking about. We'll get into it. So for those that don't know, the Big Brother 4 blockumentary, as I mentioned, is going to be have its final part released this week. If you're listening in the present time, if you're listening in the past, then great news. It's already all the way out. But the blockumentary goes through Big Brother 4, all of the episodes, recaps and analyzes, talks about the episodes and what was going on the feeds at the time, which has been very valuable to me as a Big Brother historian. You can just imagine me with like a top hat and a pipe, like kicking my legs up in a big fuzzy red chair as I go over the antique Big Brother 4 feeds. That's how historians operate, right? That's their office. So if you haven't already, make sure you check that out. It's never been a better time to listen up on Big Brother 4. And we also, of course, have Big Brother 2 and Big Brother 3 available for purchase. Big Brother 4 has been free this particular offseason because of the lack of other Big Brother content that we have received. So we wanted to release something for free in the meantime. But check it out if you want. And let's get into this particular podcast. So this is, of course, a Big Brother focused podcast. This is mostly talking about the terminology, what floating means, but the concept applies broadly in all social strategy games. If you listened to the Evolution of Alliance Structure podcast, then you definitely heard me use the term floating quite a bit. The basic concept that I used was, it means you're basically just trying to get in good with everybody. It's the most basic form of it that you can use, I think. It can get more specific. You can say that it's somebody that aligns with multiple people, that floats to power, that floats between alliances, that floats around with their loyalty. You can try to apply the term in many ways. But the most important part of what a floater is, to anybody that understands what the term is and is using it as a descriptor of strategy, is that a floater is not locked down in an alliance. A floater tries to maintain relationships with as many people as they can to put themselves in the most advantageous position, no matter what happens and who wins power week to week. It's actually pretty basic, and many people attempt to do this. But obviously, if you are known for doing this in the game itself, your reputation will be sullied. People won't want to work with you if they think that you'll just jump ship the second things get rough, which is really why there's a distinction at all, because many people do not attempt to do this. Many people just say, hey, here are my people in this game. I'm going to just stay loyal to them the whole way through. They're my ride or dies, and I'm going to ride all the way to the end with them, whether we win or lose. Which is not to say that the difference between a floater and a non-floater is strictly loyalty, because there are non-floaters that end up not being particularly loyal. You wouldn't really call them a floater. They're not actively floating. They just aren't very loyal. So the best example, the most easy to understand example, comes from Big Brother 4. In Big Brother 4, there were two main alliances, two sides of the house. There were the original eight people that entered the house first. They called themselves the Elite Eight. Then there were another group of five people that entered the house late. They were all exes of the people who were already in the house, five of them at least, meaning they once dated somebody in the house. That group of five were called the exes initially. And these two sides of the house basically kept this distinction all the way through the game, with each side taking a hit one after another, all the way down, with each side taking hits, scoring hits, all the way down to the end. So everyone in those two alliances, those two groups, were basically just regular non-floating players. But there were two players in the game that decided that that wasn't enough for them: June and Allison. What they did essentially was, each week that one of the groups was in power, they would run to that group and pretend that they were loyal to them. Then the next week, when the other group got in power, they'd run to the other side and say, hey, I'm loyal to you. This is a vast oversimplification of what was going on in that season, and you can hear much more about it on the Big Brother 4 blockumentary. But that's the basics of what a floater is. Now, especially in Big Brother 4, at a time when playing the game too hard is still very much seen as morally wrong, certainly not honorable, the idea of somebody not being loyal to any one group is not well respected. So when June and Allie switch back and forth, the other players in the game say, that's not a respectable strategy. They are floaters. They're not loyal. They're not worthy of our respect. They're doing something that anybody could do, but we're choosing not to do because we have more honor. And it's very possible that had Allie and June not made it to the end together, they wouldn't have been able to beat anybody else in the house because their strategy was not well respected. So that's the well-accepted origin of what a floater is and what the strategy is. The first time it ever shows up on an episode of the show, it is Allie in the diary room calling herself a floater, saying that she's willing to float to either side of the house when it suits her. Now, this concept will evolve over time, and it will get more complicated than one person floating between two sides. And as I talked about in the evolution of alliance structure, you can, in a way, float as a group by teaming up with other people, and then as a group, as an alliance, try to make inroads with as many different people as possible and try to cover yourself on as many bases as you can. So over the course of time, many people who are knowledgeable about Big Brother will say, okay, but at some point, the definition of what a floater is changed. Many people will point to Rachel Riley in season 13 saying, floaters grab a life vest, meaning you players that are not really doing much, that are just floating by, it's time to grab a life vest because I'm going to sink you. And as time went on in future seasons, the term continued to be used more as a way of describing a passive player, one that just floats passively through the game and doesn't have much agency, much to the chagrin of many Big Brother fans who, every time the word floater is used incorrectly, it hurts their heart. So those people often will go, no. This is not floating. This is coasting. Coasting is what you do when you're just a passive participant in the season. You are the Victoria. You are the cowboy. These people are called floaters, but the fan base would prefer that you call them coasters, because floating is a strategy. It's active. That's the difference. And this is very valid. And I think the distinction is a good one. But where does this confusion come from? When was the term really coined, and when did it really change? And why do people keep wanting to use it in a derisive way? Well, I did some research. Going all the way back to Big Brother 3, there's a lot of difficulty in doing a lot of research on Big Brother 2, though there are bits that you can find. But the first real reference that I could find to any term regarding floating or using the term floater to describe someone was actually in Big Brother 3. None other than Jason Guy calls himself a floater, which is actually super apt, especially if you listen to the Development of Alliance Structure podcast. Jason Guy with Danielle really revolutionizes the floating game. He does it with a secret partner. He very much was a floater in that game, and he calls himself such. But interestingly, despite the fact that he's using it, according to our standards, correctly, as he's using it, talking to other house guests that are playing the game at the time, he's actually using it in the way that we often don't like people using it. He says first to Kiki, "I'm not a floater. I'm not just somebody that is floating along." And then later says to Roddy, "I'm sorry, I was a floater. I was just afraid and hoping to make it through, but no more. Now I'll play the game." Now, this term didn't really catch on here in Big Brother 3. Nobody in the game really used it to describe Jason or his game. He doesn't really use it that often. In fact, he's only really using it to explain himself to people that he is ultimately letting down. But I thought it was interesting. Jason is truly one of the original floaters, one of the people who was doing it before anybody even knew what to call it. And oddly enough, he identifies himself as one, but in the incorrect definition and not the one that is correct, which actually describes him. So fast forward to Big Brother 4. It's difficult to know exactly where the term floater was coined in this particular season, but there were some interesting conversations that happened prior to the first time that it's used to describe somebody's game. One conversation in particular. I have no idea if this has anything to do with why the word is used eventually, but Erica and Jack have a conversation about big threats in the game. The big threats, they're all targeting each other. They're all going after each other. It's the small threats that aren't being targeted. And their thoughts move to the fish tank. They say, yeah, the big fish are all taking each other out. So Jack says, I have an idea. I'll be a jellyfish, just floating around the other big fish. You know, it's best to not be perceived as a threat. That's how you get far in this game. Wouldn't that make a great origin story for the term floater, wouldn't it? Well, as I said, there's not any real evidence to point to this conversation ultimately inspiring the use later on, but it would be cool if it was. And really, it's not much longer after this conversation that Nathan from Big Brother 4, is the first person to really use this term, the first person to coin this term, yes, before Allie herself, before June. Nathan calls June a floater. Now, before he does that, he talks to Erica and Jack about how he's upset that people are just going to float on by. Again, hey, maybe they were talking about this conversation with him and maybe that's why he used the term. Probably not, but you never know. A man can dream. But again, he's using it incorrectly here, right? Incorrectly. The way that we don't like it. They're just going to float on by. They're not doing anything. They're not playing the game. They're just floating. Then, later, he has a confrontation with June. Now, if you watched the show, if you remember, or if you've been listening along to the Big Brother 4 blockumentary, you might remember Nathan has a big confrontation with June. It's in that confrontation that he calls June out on how she floats from group to group. Then later, Jack ends up talking to Allie when it's become very apparent that Allie and June are jumping back and forth from group to group. Jack tells Allie, it's transparent that you and June are the floaters in the house. So you can give a little credit to Nathan, a little credit to Jack. It's hard to know exactly where this started, but it definitely started somewhere in the trio of Erica, Jack, and Nathan, somewhere between this conversation about jellyfish and big fish and floating along and Nathan being upset that people are floating by. And then later, transposing that to mean floating from group to group. And then after Jack called Allie a floater, she was offended. She went to Justin and talked about how Jack called me a floater. I'm floating by. And it was meant as a bad thing. It really was. It was meant as both floating by and floating from group to group. There was no real distinction between the two. People didn't respect Allie and June's game at this time. They weren't trying to give them a compliment. They weren't trying to say anything like, you're playing the game well. They're not saying anything like, we respect what you're doing game-wise, but we don't trust you, or that they're doing something that is any kind of strategy, but it's dangerous, or anything like that. It's just meant to mean that they're not honorable, that they're not worthy, and they're not trustworthy. So here's where I think the confusion really starts. This is the thing that I think really divides the definition. Allie takes ownership of the term. She's being called a floater in a bad way. You're floating by. You're not doing well. You're just floating by, floating from group to group. Not an intentional game, not someone with agency. And I think, again, it's important to point this out. This definition is closer to a coaster at this time than the current definition that fans of the show have as a floater. People saw Allie as somebody that didn't have much agency in the game. They saw June as somebody that didn't have much agency in the game at this time. Many of them never come to see the agency that Allie has in the game, and that's something that we talk about a lot in the blockumentaries, that they have a warped perception of who Allie is as a player. So you might think that they're calling Allie a floater, and how could they possibly think that they mean coaster at this time? But they did mean coaster at this time. But they added in this bit about floating from group to group because that was also disgusting to them. And they did not see it as a strategy at this time. They saw it in the same way that you might see somebody who just clings to a stronger player, aka perhaps a coaster. Technically, it's a strategy, but not one with any real agency, not one that's worth really talking about in any way. But Allie takes this negative term and she decides she's going to own it. She says, you know what? I am a floater in this game. I am floating from side to side. And you know what? I'm doing it on purpose. This is my strategy and I'm doing it well. So screw these people that think that I'm not playing the game, because this is my game and they're so dumb they can't even see it. It's right in front of them. They're describing it and they still can't see it. And so Allie takes something that was meant, truly meant, always meant to be an insult. Something that was really meant to be coasting. And she makes it her own. The term catches fire in the house. Eventually, both Allie and June describe themselves as floaters, and other people describe them as floaters. And Allie and June do a great job at selling the concept and the strategy as something that is worthy of respect. And by the end of the season, you do have Justin, who prior to all of that did talk about how they were floaters and how it wasn't respectable. But at the end of the season, he has to admit, he says, you know what? I have to respect the strategy. Allie and June turned him around. They turned the whole audience around on the concept of what a floater is. And this is why I think it's so difficult to nail this term down, because the way that we are using it is not the way it was ever meant to be used. It was two women being insulted, taking the term and fighting against the current, saying, no, you want to call us floaters? Then this is us floating. And they made it to the final two. And their example still stands there, but the current keeps rushing. And so in Big Brother 5, we do still have the term floater. Karen calls Adria a floater. She calls Nokomis a floater. Later, Karen and Will are both called floaters. And that's really what catches on. Karen and Will, they're floaters. And it's being used correctly here. Karen and Will were floaters to a degree. It wasn't quite the same as it was in Big Brother 4. But what they're really meaning when they say this is that these people don't have any true loyalties. You need to be worried about these people because they're not true to your alliance. They will jump ship on you. This is correct. This is how we use the term floater nowadays. It's still being used as an insult, as a negative thing, but it's correct. In Big Brother 6, you have Kacer and Michael calling James a floater, which was even more true than I think they ever realized. Sarah and Eric calling Kaser a floater, meaning he's not trustworthy. He will jump ship on you. Later, Maggie in particular is really going to label James a floater because he floats from group to group. Allie and June, they changed the definition. It's being used in the way that they said it should be. But here's where things actually start to shift. Not in Big Brother 13, but in Big Brother 7, All-Stars. Big Brother 7 is probably the season where the term floater is used more than any other season. It's reached a breaking point. First of all, you have Allie back. So obviously the term floater is going to be on people's minds. But also you have returning players, people like Kaser, like James, people who know the term. So you'd think this is where it really solidifies that it's a strategy, that it's intentional, that this is going to be used correctly. And it was, but in a weird way. For those of you that remember All-Stars, you'll remember that the big storyline of the first half of the season was the Season 6 Alliance winning HOHs over and over back to back, and Dr. Will staying safe. How did he stay safe? He made a deal. Will and Kaser were butting heads. Will had a group, so to speak. Kaser had a group, so to speak, and they were big fish, so they made a deal. The big fish will negotiate a ceasefire. And this is somewhat revolutionary at this time. You know, you see Maggie tricking Howie into it in Season 6. You see people like Natalie and Adria get caught trying to play multiple sides and leaving because of it. But this is the first time that we really see this used intentionally as a strategy from two different sides. You see Will and Kaser agree the big fish need to negotiate a ceasefire and target the floaters. These hangers-on that will pretend to be loyal to us while we're in power and then switch sides when we're not. Those are the real dangers. And they are. And they were. It's smart what they're doing. They're evolving the game in this moment. But there's a thing that happens in social strategy games, especially ones like Big Brother, where there's a lot of time to talk. You tend to villainize your enemies. So the more people talked about targeting floaters, you need to kind of come up with justification for it, right? Yeah, it's strategically sound, but you also get to feel good about it. These are your friends, people that are pretending to be loyal to you. And so as time went on, it kind of developed into this weird sort of, yes, we're targeting the floaters because of their strategy, but also they don't deserve to be here. I mean, that's sort of where the term originated in the first place. It's always been used as an insult, right? It's just furthering the insult. They're not loyal, sure. They're also not playing the game, really. I mean, they're just staying quiet. They don't have to talk. They don't have to stand up for anything. They're just kind of floating by, really. Pretty soon, people are calling Chicken George a floater. In a funny moment, Howie will tell Will that he's a floater, meaning that he's doing nothing. Nokomis will even rewrite history and say from her season, Cowboy was a floater because he didn't do anything. And this is what I was talking about with the current. Yeah, Allie and June, they stood their ground and they said, you know what? We are a floater. And we're proud of it. And this is what it means. And we did it on purpose. But the term just naturally flows in a different way. People want it to be bad. That's how it started. They don't want to respect floaters. And so the more people talked about it, the more it was used derisively. And importantly, this made the edit. We're targeting the floaters. And you get this famous scene later on where Dr. Will describes to Janelle who the floaters are and what they do with the little rubber duckies in the tub. And even then, he's using it right. He's describing it correctly, but he's doing so in such a derogatory way. So now you have this weird mixture of some people who don't really even seem to understand what a floater is, like Howie Nokomis. You have some people like Dr. Will and Kaser who do know what a floater is, but it's not exactly in their interest to correct the misunderstandings of the people who don't, because it works in their favor. And they even have incentive to justify it to themselves, that these people, they just don't do anything, they don't deserve it. So that's why we should target them. And this weird mixture is enough. It's more than enough. What makes the show is more than enough to make it so that by Big Brother 8, the term has shifted back to its original state. In fact, even further back than its original state, because in the original state, it was still at least a little bit floating from group to group. In Big Brother 8, you have people with no concept of what a floater really is. Jessica and Danielle call Zach a floater because he's not doing anything. Mike calls Jen a floater because she's not doing anything. She's just genning there. And in another case of dramatic irony, Nick, Danielle, and Dustin will call Eric a floater early on in the game, which is another bit of like, well, yeah. But what they meant was, he's got to step it up. This Eric guy, he's not doing anything. He's such a floater. He needs to step up his game. The damage has been done by the All-Stars themselves. And people are now using this term in an incorrect, according to how we like to use it, way. So flash forward to Big Brother 13. Rachel says, floaters, grab a life vest. She's not wrong. She's using it in the way that it's been used for 5 seasons. The way that it really was originally intended to be used from Jason and Big Brother 3 and from Erica and Jack and Nathan. Sure, Allie and June, they changed the definition. And I do agree that it should be there. And I think that we will continue to use it that way. I don't think we should fault Rachel here. I think she is unfairly criticized. In fact, I think that what she really did was she brought the term back to life. People said, hey, wait a minute. That's not right, though. And just a couple seasons later, Andy is truly going to revitalize it. Because, of course, again, people are calling Andy a floater. That's a bad thing. And they think he's a rat as well. Some call him a rat floater. He's called this by people who hate him, mostly. And what does Andy do? He says, yeah, I am a rat floater. And it worked for me. You can hate it all you want. You want to look at my bank account? Because I did that on purpose. I mean, there's a lot of comparisons that people make to Andy and June and Allie and the way that he played the game, but it's really also in the way that he owned that game. And he took something that was meant to be an insult and he decided to make it a compliment. And now we have this confusion. People who don't really respect Andy's game, who didn't really ever get the resurgence of the term, and they listen to Rachel Riley and they still use floater as a means of saying coaster. And you have other people who know the history of the show or who do respect Andy's game and understand that floating is a good strategy when you do it intentionally. And these two clash. And I think they will continue to clash because the word was always meant to be an insult. But there were a few people along the way that decided to take the insult and shove it right back into the faces of the people who said it. And that's truly in the spirit of Big Brother. And that's why I think, despite the fact that the term maybe didn't originate in the way that it's being used by the fans, it doesn't matter. It's unique. And it's honestly not super intuitive, which is why it keeps defaulting to this insult thing. But that doesn't matter because it does make sense when you think about it. It's so clever to turn it from just floating along to floating on purpose, to floating your loyalty back and forth, to spread it out. It's clever and it's defiant and it's awesome. And it has such a rich history. I mean, I think that we should cling to this term. And when people use it incorrectly, I don't think you need to get mad about it. I think the fact that people still use it incorrectly, in a way, it only adds to the character of it. So how did floating develop as a strategy? We talked about how it developed as a term, but what about the concept, the strategic nature of it? How did that develop in the players and in the show? Of course, it all goes back to Big Brother 2. And even before Dr. Will, you did have Krista, who's really the first real attempt at it, trying to please both sides, trying to play both sides, trying to make sure that when she wasn't in power, she would be able to drift to either side. She wasn't very good at it, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was in part what inspired Dr. Will. It is kind of an instinctual response to a game like this, I think. But Dr. Will is going to pick up where Krista failed, and he is going to succeed. He buddies up to the person in power, he makes a deal, and he focuses their target elsewhere. Some key elements to being a floater exist all the way back to where Will is. And this is where Krista actually failed. Krista was trying to play both sides, but there's a key element to floating as an individual. And this is what I want to focus on, individual floating. I've already talked about floating as an alliance, which is ultimately a more successful and dominant strategy in the game if you can get an alliance that can operate in that way. But floating as an individual is kind of its own thing. And the key components to it are being able to maintain good relationships with as many people as possible, and also making sure that your threat level is as low as possible. These two things conflict. The more connections and relationships you have, the more threatening you are. So the more you develop these relationships and connections, the more you need to pull in the opposite direction and make sure that you're not seen as a threat. Dr. Will did this by playing up how hated he was. He He'll never win in the end. Drag him all the way to the final two, you win in a landslide. And on top of that, can't win a competition to save his life. It's important to keep your threat level low so that what happens in All-Stars does not happen to you. The key to floating is that you have a better relationship with whoever is in power than the people who aren't in power, or the people who you need them to target, whoever is not you. You need to be able to say, why are you coming after me when you got these people over here? And having a good relationship, having good social skills, having good connections will help you do that. But the key is that they can't think that you're worth the shot. And nobody thought Will was worth the shot. And because of that, he was able to survive. And now, again, it's not just surviving either. It's more strategic than that. You have more agency than that. It's surviving because your threat level is low, but also having those connections and being able to influence the game in your favor. So you're able to point people elsewhere because it's not worth going after you, but you're also able to direct where that target gets pointed because of the good relationship that you have. And you're able to pick off the members of each side that you need to have picked off in order to further your agency in the game. This is what Dr. Will does. He makes it to the end, he wins, and floating succeeds. In season 3, Danielle and Jason do what Dr. Will did, but from the start, and they do it as a team. I talked about this in the Alliance Structure podcast. Now we are going to take a quick break for our sponsors, and we'll be right back. And we're back. So let's get back to the show. It's not until season 4 that we see the individual floating strategy develop a little bit further. June and Allie start doing it a little bit earlier than Will does. And what's interesting about June and Allie is that they're both attempting to do what Dr. Will did at the same time. They're competing floaters. When I talked about how it's an oversimplification to say that they were just floating back and forth to power, I meant it. Because what was really happening is that oftentimes they'd be flipping back and forth to opposite sides at the same time. Meaning June would flip to the X's while Allie stayed with the Elite Eight. And then Allie would flip to the X's and June would flip back to the Elite Eight. And for a while, they were exclusively targeting each other because they recognized that the only person that could really screw up what they were doing was the other person doing the same thing. And they were essentially strangling each other and preventing each other from having any influence over the game. And they were tanking themselves both. But they were both still so good at what they were doing that they were able to survive long enough to realize, okay, hold on. What if we worked together on this? Now, before that happens, I do want to quickly just talk about the different ways that they approached this. June's threat level was low because she didn't win many competitions for a long time in the season. People didn't see her as much of a threat there. She also didn't have a lot of visible alliances. The only real alliance that people could see that she had was with G, and that was secret. G was her ex, and so even though that was a connection that people could see, it wasn't an alliance that they could see. And so she hit it very successfully. That's how she kept her threat level down. Allie, on the other hand, was a big presence in the game, and she did win competitions, and she made herself very threatening. So her method of lowering her threat level was part Dr. Will, everybody hates me, and part acting, manipulating. Allie was somebody that liked to play up different sides of herself in extreme ways. And so Allie played this angle of, I'm not strategic. I'm an emotional player. I'm just being led by my heart. And we go into more detail in the Big Brother 4 documentary because this is, in a way, it's true. But she did play it up a lot, and it helped keep her threat level down along with the everybody hates me thing. So two different methods of doing the same thing, and they both had influence over the game until they decide to work together, and they become much greater than the sum of their parts. Now, after that, you have some floating here and there. Drew does some with Diane. We obviously see James attempt this in Big Brother 6, but Maggie is there to shoot him down. A few different people try this in groups and individually in All Stars, but they're pretty wise to it. They target the floaters. Jace is trying it. Will and Boogie are again floaters. James again tries to be a bit of a floater. Danielle again tries to group up and float. Not many individual successful floaters, though. It's hard. It's hard to do. And it's easier and it's more successful to do it with people. Eric is kind of forced into it in a way, but he still is able to bring a group with him. Dan is probably the next closest successful individual floater since June, because he has a similar start to Dr. Will in that they lose their original alliance and then start floating. But then Dan continues to build from there and eventually has a group around him. Dan is essentially, Dan in season 10 is like the development of strategy in Big Brother all in one season. From the very start in Big Brother 2 to the pinnacle of what alliance structure meant in season 10 by the end of the season. So then it's not until, of course, we see Andy really succeed at individual floating in season 14. And he takes the individual floating game a step further than anybody has in the past. And he is definitely still the best example of an individual floater. So much so that people had to call it something different. And again, they were doing this to insult him, but it's called rat floating because it seems so far evolved from what June did in season 4, so far evolved from the original concept that it doesn't seem right to call it the same thing. Call it rat floating. It was a little bit extra in there. Now, could somebody really describe to you what rat floating was and what the difference between rat floating and regular floating was? They'd probably just say, well, they rat people out a lot. But let me tell you, if you don't remember, June and Allie ratted people out constantly. Way more so than Andy, I will say. You could probably count on one hand how many secrets they kept in the game that had to do with anybody but themselves. No, what really makes Andy's game different from all the floating that came before, the individual floating that came before, is that Andy is the first person to successfully float all season long as an individual without getting caught. Dr. Will was obvious. June and Allie were obvious. Everybody that attempted it from 5 to 13 either was obvious but still succeeded because of that lower threat level and influence, or they got caught and failed. Dan is probably the closest in season 10. He never really gets caught floating until a moment where he decides to leave that version of his game behind and start to build. But Andy, from start to finish, is floating as an individual, and never once does he get caught as a floater. People think that he's a team player all season long. That's what sets Andy's game apart. And that's what nobody has been able to replicate. In some ways, Andy's game is more similar to like a Paul from Big Brother 19 than it is to June or Allie. But in some ways, he is truly the next incarnation of June or Allie. He is somewhere in the middle of that Venn diagram where Paul or Derek had these alliance structures that they worked within. Andy had alliances and he had different groups of people, but his house wasn't built for an alliance structure like the ones that Derek or Paul were able to create. Andy's house was a house of gamers with a bunch of different groups, a bunch of different alliances that formed and broke up. And instead of trying to carve out this big floating onion-shaped alliance that we've talked about before, instead of doing that, he played as an individual and floated along with these alliances. That's not groundbreaking. What was groundbreaking, again, is that he never got caught doing it. He was able to slither in, and people talked about this all the time. It frustrated viewers. He was allowed anywhere in the house. He would run into rooms, code red. He had relationships with every single individual. They trusted him with information. He was able to minimize his threat level despite being the most connected person in the house. He didn't win too many competitions early on. He's able to influence the boot order to suit his needs. Here's how I would look at it. If you're still having trouble really conceptualizing the difference between, say, June's game, Andy's game, and, say, Derek's game. In June's game, there are two platforms that are disintegrating as time goes on. Every week, a piece of the platform breaks off and falls to the abyss, and people often go down with it. So in her game, she jumped from one platform to another as a piece would fall from it so that she was in the safe platform. and then she'd jump back when another piece fell. And she did that all season until both platforms were about to break. That's the simplified version. In Derek's game, there was one big platform with a few small ones littered about. He used the big platform to crush the small ones, and then he stood in the center of the big platform and let the outer rings start to fall one by one until he was there standing at the center. In Andy's game, there were a bunch of scattered platforms, some bigger than others, but all throughout the game, Andy jumped around those platforms, nimbly avoiding any one of them that crumbled, actively influencing which ones crumbled at which times and making sure that he was in the best position to benefit each time. And when we talk about jumping from platform to platform, what we're talking about is floating from platform to platform. And that's why we wouldn't really call Derek a floater. He stayed on the same platform. He floated the platform around to crush the other platforms, but he never really left his own. Not really an individual floater. He pilots the ship. He pilots the platform itself. Players like Andy or June, they float as individuals. They float two platforms. And I want to be clear, one is not better than the other. They take different skill sets, and there's a different level of difficulty in each one. In fact, I'd argue that floating as an individual is harder than floating as an alliance. Floating as an alliance is a more dominant strategy, more likely to bring you success. And we can go back and forth about what that means in terms of who's a better player or who's played a better game. And that all, of course, goes back to the jury management podcast that I tell where I talked about some of that. But there is a distinction, and hopefully now you understand what that is. So, of course, a podcast about floating would not be complete without hearing from the pinnacle of floating himself, Andy Herron. So I want to talk about that. Like, how did you avoid getting caught, and how did you like operate as a floater?
I mean, I truly, truly did just like every day when I woke up, I would like lay in bed and just think to myself, like, what can you do so that you're not a target but from anybody? And my thing was that like, I actually couldn't believe I didn't get caught sometimes. It's like, I would be like, Amanda, so-and-so is trying to flip the house on you, but like, please, I'm squashing it. Don't worry about it. Just don't mention this to anyone. I'm just telling you, so you know what's going on. And then Amanda would say something. And then it's like Jesse or like Howard or someone, whoever had told me, I was just like, how are you not tracing this back to me? You know what I'm saying? Like, I just feel like I consistently would get like completely off scot-free. And I mean, I think it helped that I had allies like Amanda and like Helen, who were always going to be like bigger targets than me. Even if like someone thought information came from me, they still thought that the other people that I was aligned with were like bigger issues. And so I feel like that, like the information coming from me kind of took a back burner, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I really did try very carefully to make sure that I was always in everyone's good graces. And I guess like the fact that I ingratiated myself so well with pretty much everybody, nobody ever really thought that I was going to be the person that would betray them, you know? And so even if information got out, they would be like, oh, he's just doing that to like help his game and my, and like, I'm with him. And so, you know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like no one ever really took things personally when I would leak information, even if they kind of knew that it had come from me, you know?
Yeah. I think that like the two main components that I feel like, are like really what goes into making a floater game work is, like, having good relationships with as many people as possible and being able to lower your threat level as much as possible. So like going all the way back to Dr. Will in season two, who was absolutely a floater, you know, after his alliance gets voted out, he maintained relationships with as many people as he could, and he kept his threat level down by not winning competitions and by saying, everyone hates me, bring me to the end.
No, that is like, no, I mean, I very much in that same vein, I feel like I did not want to win. I mean, I didn't get picked to play in the first 7 vetoes. So like that was lucky. And then HOHs, I very rarely wanted to win them. Like truly the first time I wanted to win one, I guess I kind of wanted to win week 2 when I was partnered with Alyssa, and I knew that like Jeremy and Aaron were like neck and neck with us. I kind of wanted to win that one. But other than that, the first time I ever wanted to win one was when I won one in like week 8. And I feel like I wasn't winning competitions, and I would go to the diary room so rarely. I would like play that up. I would be like, just let everyone know, like, I'm completely irrelevant. I'm never in the diary room, which like was annoying to me because I was like, well, they're not talking whatsoever about everything that I'm doing. But it was also good for me game wise because I could use it to my advantage and be like, oh, I'm a nothing. Don't worry about me, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I think where you really excelled is that most people, when they play the game, try to have as many relationships as possible. Unfortunately, not everyone tries very hard, but most people try. But you really succeeded there. Like, you had a relationship with every person in the house.
Yeah,
and you have that famous montage where you win the HOH and everyone's like, I feel great about this, because they each had their own individual relationship with you, which is, it's easy to say, well, he succeeded because he had a relationship with everybody. But pulling that off without people catching on that you have a relationship with everybody or being threatened by it is what made you succeed. So, what is it about your game that allowed that to happen?
I mean, I really think it's kind of simple. I truly did just ask people questions about themselves and was inquisitive and caring. And I feel like not a lot of people are like that towards everybody. And I feel like it really goes a long way if you've got good people skills and good listening skills. A lot of the people in that house only wanted to talk about themselves. And so it's I went to them and I asked them about themselves and they got closer to me. You know, it always baffles me when I'll hear someone will be evicted and they'll just be I got evicted because I never really want to talk about a household. I was just what? I couldn't, even the people that I had absolutely nothing in common with, I would find something in common with them and sit down and talk to them about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel as it kept going, I mean, it definitely got more and more stressful as the summer went on. For the beginning, I feel I was just friendly with everybody and I definitely had my allegiances, but I had Amanda who I would just feed information to and she would get all the work done for me. But then when I had to be a little bit more on my own, and I feel towards the middle of the game, I just felt I was juggling 100 plates. And if I stopped juggling at any minute, one of them would fall and then they would all come crashing down. And I luckily, towards the middle and the end, I just always had to be on and really careful with what I was saying to people, but it was risky. But also I feel I really was so cognizant of my place and how everyone felt with me and whatever, what certain people knew and what other people didn't know or what other people knew or didn't know. So it worked. I mean, it was mentally exhausting to be juggling all those plates, like I said, but still at the end of it, I was very aware of everything. For example, when we would drink, I up until the very end was oh, I can't get drunk because I'm going to if I say even the slightly wrong thing, then I can be exposed, you know?
Yeah.
And so I just never really had my guard down.
I wonder how much some of it at the start of the game was the fact that it felt like you didn't take a lot of credit for what you were doing at the time, not only because you weren't given much credit, but you also didn't have much of an ego about your game at the start of it.
Right.
And you were very willing to let other people be the big players. And,
oh, for sure.
And I think that a lot of people, when they are trying to be a floater and when they're trying to get in good with everybody, the fact that they have that much power, kind of can get to your head and they start to use it too much.
Yeah, I feel like it's when you see people on Survivor, it's always the edit that you know they're going to come out of it screwed when they're just I'm the swing vote, I'm in control of everything. You know what I'm saying? I feel like people get like that and you need to just be humble, you know? I mean, I truly was, for a lot of the game, I wasn't oh, I'm going to win, I've got this in my bag. I was I am nervous. I have my eggs in this basket and I think that I'm handling the basket well, but if I could be wrong, you know what I'm saying? I just I never really did get cocky because I truly didn't feel that cocky.
Mm-hmm.
I was always kind of nervous and hyper aware of everything and just had my finger on the pulse of everything and on how everyone was feeling. But at the same time, I thought to myself, I've seen people get blindsided before. I'm not going to be one of those people that just thinks I'm running this and then be out of here the next week, you know?
Yeah. So, what would be if somebody went into the game? Because I feel like the individual floater game is something that's very difficult to pull off. And I talked about alliance structure and how that's sort of a more dominant strategy because it's sort of easier to accomplish in a way. But it's not always possible for everyone, depending on the cast that you're in or depending on your own personality. Some people just aren't capable or able or put in a situation where they're able to just like shape the house the way they want and create these big, right. massive alliances. Sometimes you are an outcast. Sometimes you're a minority. Sometimes you have to work with the cards that are dealt to you. And the individual floater right. game is kind of something that anybody can do, but it's very hard to pull off. So if somebody went into the house or they find themselves in the house and they have to attempt like playing the game on your own, you don't have a partner in crime, you don't have a core group of people around you that you can rely on, what would your tips be for how to play this individual floater game?
I mean, I still think that one of the best ways to do it ever, and if the opportunity arises, and like hopefully it would, but like for me, and then like I saw it happen a couple of seasons later, I'll explain in a second, but like I was fifth wheel for two dominant couples. Like it's like there was Helen and Alyssa on one side and Amanda and McCray on the other side. And it's like, I was like, oh, these are two duos that like all have a common interest right now. We want to get out with the stronger men, you know? And I was like, I'm going to attach myself to these two because if the other side of the house gets power, they're going to want to take out Amanda or McCray or Helen or Alyssa. They're not going to nominate me. They're going to want to get rid of one of those duos. And then when the duos eventually start turning on each other, they're going to turn on each other and not on me. And I'm still right there. And like, I'm safely in the middle. And so I feel like try to like if you know that you're by yourself, why not attach yourself to a duo or a couple duos like that? Like I remember in season 18, I was so frustrated with Devon because like that opportunity, the exact opportunity came to her. I think it was like, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was like Nicole and Corey and like Polly and Zakir, right? They wanted to work with Devon. Mm-hmm. And she was like, I'm not going to be fifth wheel for two showmances. And I was like, yes, you should be. Like, I was like, what are you doing? That is exactly what you want to be. And I feel like she didn't take the bait and she was gone way sooner than I think she would have been if she had actually done that. Mm-hmm. And so I guess like if you're at the beginning or like the early middle of the game and those duos are there, work with them. And then, I mean, with me, I truly just like my end game. I mean, I knew that I was never going to go to the end with Amanda and McCray or Helen and Alyssa because like Helen and Amanda, I was symbiotic with both of them. Like I fed them information and they got the work done, but I was like, they're getting the work done. And so I was just like, I can't let them get to the end with me because like they're being the aggressors. And if I'm sitting at the end, even though like I've been just as important to them as they've been to me, because they wouldn't be able to be aggressive about the information I'm giving them. I was like, they could easily beat me. And so I kept around like Gina Marie and Spencer. And then when Judd came back, I was like, go to the end with the people that you can just win your way out of. You know what I'm saying? Like I won three of the last four competitions and basically like won my way to the end because I was there with like weaker competitors, you know?
Yeah. And I think a couple of key elements of your game was your influence over the boot order. The fact that you were able to make sure that the right people were around at the time you needed them. And then combining that with the timing of knowing when you needed to strike to make your end game move. So like what would be your tips on how to accomplish those two things?
I mean, I think that you need to just be subtle about it. Like, I feel like there are so many big egos that are always there. I feel like if someone can sense that you're like trying to push your agenda on them, it can go sour. And so basically what I would do is I was like kind of insidious. I would just be like, over and over to like Helen and Amanda, I would be like, man, Judd has been acting so weird. I just like don't know what's up with him. And then like a couple of days later, they were both just like, ooh, if it's a double, should we backdoor him? And I was like, oh yeah, what a good idea, Helen and Amanda. And you know what I'm saying? Like make them think that it's like their move, but just like subtly influence them. So that you're getting what you want done and it's not looking like you're getting you are like the mastermind behind it. And I mean, to be honest, those first like five or six boots, I truly just like didn't really care as long as it wasn't one of my allies. Mm-hmm. And so I wasn't like with like Howard, I wasn't just like, I'm like Amanda was very, very dead set in getting rid of Howard. And so I was just like, okay. Like, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. I truly like, I would go unless one of my allies was being targeted, I would just go wherever everyone wanted me to go because I was essentially getting like, it didn't matter. I had so many people that I wanted to just get out, but it didn't really matter like what order it was. And then like when things would start to switch, like week five and six, when people were just like, oh, we're going to flip the house on Amanda. Then I was like, okay, now I need to like act and I cannot let this happen. And you know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like, I think, yeah, it was like the week that Howard went home and the week that Candace went home. Yeah. Like, the house would have flipped on Amanda if I wouldn't have stopped it, you know? And I was just like, this can't happen. I need Amanda here. And so I just like attached myself to the powerful people, let them kind of choose the boot order. But it was a boot order that like I was already okay with. Mm-hmm. And then if any of my allies was in danger, I would like come in and help them, you know?
Yeah. And I think, again, that speaks to sort of like your restraint, that you were able to like sit on the influence that you did have and not waste it on moments when it didn't matter as much,
exactly.
When it might have been a losing battle and you held on at for the right timing, which is what you really nailed.
Like even when Caitlin went home, Caitlin was like a really good friend of mine, but I was just like, and I, for a while I was trying, like, I was just like, I like Caitlin. I would like to work with Caitlin, but then she just kept going to the wrong people. And I was finally just like, screw it. I was like, I have to like, just give up. I have tried, I like her, but like, she's not willing to like take the bait that I'm giving her. And it's just not worth it. And like, I'm not going to blow up my game to this person who just like, doesn't seem to care that much. And so thus I kind of like had to let Caitlin go, you know?
Yeah. I think so much of it too just comes down to instincts and being able to know in the moment like when you should push and when you shouldn't.
Right. And that's the thing. It's like if you have your finger on the pulse of the house, then like I really think it's not that hard to do if you just sit back and listen and observe and like don't make everything about yourself. You know, I mean, essentially you are making everything about yourself because you're just trying to survive. But it's like if you actually listen to other people and like see who's with who, and it's like for me it truly wasn't that hard to suss out what was going on. You know, I mean, I literally was told, like, except for like week one about the moving company. After that, I knew exactly how every vote was going to go. I knew, like, you know what I'm saying? Like when Spencer would be on the block, I think I gained so much trust with him because I would be like, hey, just so you know, it's going to be 7-1. Like you are staying. And then it would always be like the exact vote that I told them. Mm-hmm. And I was never like surprised by anything, you know, just because everyone told me everything.
So when you were playing the game, were you like consciously aware that like I am a floater right now? Or was that something that like afterward, so, when people were calling you a rat floater, you came to?
I guess I really in the game didn't really look at myself like a floater. I looked at myself more as like very like, I mean, I guess this is the way I'm going to describe this is essentially being a floater, but it's not how I looked at it. I was like very, very loyal. Until I wasn't, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's like, I was so loyal to Helen at the beginning and then to Amanda and McCray. And then it's like, I was loyal to Amanda and McCray until I didn't need to be anymore. And then one, and then it's like, I essentially did just like float from Amanda and McCray to the exterminators, et cetera. But like where my loyalty lied, I was like fiercely loyal. Like I said, the weeks that I was with Amanda, Amanda would have gone home pre-jury if I hadn't swooped in and like been like, no, we cannot do this. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, like I said, I guess that totally is floating, but I still feel like floaters don't seem to ever be given credit for having allegiances. And I truly did. It's like when I was with someone, I was really, really with them until I wasn't. You know,
And I wonder if that's maybe part of why you didn't get caught as much, because when you look at floaters that get caught or that are exposed, like, you know, Dr. Will, June, or, you know, even like people that attempted it, like maybe like a Ronnie or like, you know, people that tried and failed, they all, I think, are looking. I don't think any of them really can claim loyalty to the people that they were floating for or around. They often looked at it like, I'm playing both sides, I'm in the middle, I'm doing all these things. But you were almost like a method actor. You were like, you went into one group and you were like, this is my life. And then you were like, actually, hold on, this one.
Right. And yeah, I mean, I don't know what else to say, except that I truly was like very surprised. I remember like, it was like the middle of the summer. I might've been like around my first situation where I was just like, I think I can maybe win. Like I was just like, I'm lying to everyone at all times and just everyone is trusting everything that I say, and barring anything going very wrong, like if I keep doing this correctly, I think I could be okay, you know?
Yeah. And so I think like what happened to you after the game as well is like the perfect embodiment of how floating came to be what it is in the first place, which is that you came out of the house and people were very, you know, anti your game. They called you a rat floater, and you, very much like Allie did all the way back in Big Brother 4, decided to say, okay, you know, you want to call me a rat floater? Yeah, I'm a rat floater. And it was my strategy, and it was a good strategy.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. It's like the rat thing is true. It's like I consistently ratted out plans and like foiled plans, you know, but it's like because I was so loyal to who I was with, if I found out a plan that was going to hurt them, I had to squash it.
Yeah. So because people talk about this, the definition of a floater, like, does it mean coaster? Does it mean the intentional strategy? And I think it's people like you, I think, who have like held the torch and been like, you've weathered the storm of people trying to push floater back into an insult.
I mean, I'm sorry, like, if this sounds like I'm conceited and I'm high on myself, but it's like, I think the way that I played is so much harder than if you're in like a giant alliance, which is like keeping you the whole time. It's like, I had to be consistently on my toes. I didn't know what to say to who and when to say it. Like, I feel like I was alone, and it's like, I didn't have just like eight other people who I knew were always going to be protecting me. I did have fierce allies that I knew were not going to come after me, but I feel like I truly would like wake up every day just being like, what can I do to make sure that whoever is in a household won't nominate me? And that's what I did. That's exactly what I did. You know, like, if I could sense that like there was a little discord between me and someone else, I would fix it like immediately, because I didn't want to ever even be somewhat of a target for anyone.
Yeah. And I completely agree. Like, and that's sort of almost like the purpose of the development of Alliance Structure podcast that I did, was like, that is the dominant strategy. It is the one that succeeds the most. And it is difficult to pull off, but you, like, a lot of people have pulled it off to a degree, and it's how many people win the game. But when I've talked about floating in this podcast, like, you really are like the only person who has pulled off the individual floater game in the way that you did.
Right.
And I do think that you are sort of like the pinnacle of what it means to do that. And I do think that that's a harder way of winning. It's harder to pull off than other kinds of strategy. And so there's a lot of interesting, you know, discussion around, you know, what that means for like, was your game more impressive? Was it better? Was it whatever? But, it's definitely something that I think was impressive. And I think that, I'm really curious to see if anybody is ever able to replicate what you did.
Right. I mean, it would be interesting. Like, it's funny because as like a student of the show and someone who loves the show so much, like, I didn't really get to, like, I'm biased in my own experience. I didn't get to watch myself. So it'd be fun to watch someone try to do it too. Like, I know that for one of the reasons why the fans all didn't like me is because the whole like character arc of a rat is like that, like, they're going to get caught and it's going to be so satisfying. And I just never got caught. Like, you know what I'm saying? There was no payoff, really. There was never like a dramatic blowout. Everybody was just like, oh yeah, it's Andy. Like, we trust him. And then they were out the door and they were like, oh shit. Like, oops. You know, like,
yeah.
I mean, it really does seem like most people, if they try it within a few weeks, they're toast. Yep. Like, they're caught, you know?
Yeah. And that, because that's how the floater game has always operated before you. Like, it was that, you know, June and Allie were floaters. Everybody knew they were floaters. They were openly called floaters. Right. They were openly going back and forth from side to side. That's what a floating game is. The strength of it is that even though people see what you're doing, they can't do anything about it because your threat level is so low and they've got these other people to deal with. But you combined that with the not getting caught, and really just like, elevated it to a new level, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think like the whole thing is, I think you need to consistently be one of the biggest threats in the house that nobody knows is one of the biggest threats in the house. You know, it's like, I was very surprised that, like, if you really did just sit back a little bit, if you were anyone else on my season, you could have been like, wow, Andy is best friends with everybody. Like, everybody really likes him. And I was like, so surprised that nobody, I mean, I guess it's this kind of like weird conundrum where like nobody thought that, because I think everyone thought I was their number one. Like, they were like, oh, he's close with those people, but he's closer with me, you know? And as a result, it made everyone feel so safe.
Yeah. There's theoretically an All-Star season coming up, which unfortunately it doesn't seem like you have been invited to play.
I have not.
But if you were to go back and playing an All-Star season, or, you know, even maybe like a mixed season, but better an All-Star season, what do you think that would do for your game? Because you did play a game where you never got caught. You now go in with that reputation. What do you think that does for you?
I mean, so I think I would just have to play very differently. I could never play like I did before, because everyone's just like, oh, well, he is a threat. He is smart. And so I think I would just have to, I think I would truly just have a little bit more fun. Like, I've already won the game once before. What do I have to lose? You know what I'm saying? And so it's like, I would go in and I think I'd have to be a little bit more aggressive. And I think it would be so much more fun to play this time again, because the first time I had to just like hold my tongue. I had to be just like kind of nice to everyone. And this time I feel like that wouldn't work. And everybody knows that I'm a little shady. And so I could just like be more open, like tell people when they're being annoying. Like, and, you know, I mean, and don't get me wrong, I still would like want to win. But at the same time, like I would be able to be a little bit more myself because everyone already, I don't think I could replicate what I did the first time. Although I say that, but then again, like I truly do just think my people skills are like my best attribute in life. I'm good at talking to people. I'm good at getting people to like me. And I mean, I essentially think with all the big egos that would for sure be in an All-Stars house, I have no problem with pushing my ego aside. And I feel like I could just like last for a while just by being like nice to everyone and like getting along with people, you know?
Yeah. Well, all right. Thank you so much for chatting with me.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much for having me.
So there you go. That was Andy with some great insight. Now, I've also spoken to June recently, which if you are following along the Big Brother 4 blockumentary or you are willing to go check it out, you will hear plenty from June as well, both about her Big Brother 4 game and about floating. So make sure you check out the Big Brother 4 blockumentary if you want some more in this direction. But for now, let's get back to it. Now, Andy is truly the pinnacle of what an individual floater is. You're never really going to see another successful individual floater game. The closest you can come is probably Cliff in season 21. He does a lot of work on his own. Sometimes he works with Kat. Sometimes he works with Nicole. But he was mostly the driver and mostly individual. He got caught a lot more often than Andy did, of course, because nobody has been able to replicate what Andy did. And ultimately, he failed to succeed in the end. But it was probably the closest attempt since Andy at truly individually floating. The thing is, individual floating is often so hard to even pull off that most people either fail very quickly or they don't even attempt it. Floating with a partner or with a small group is much more likely to succeed, has a lot more outs for you, a lot more options that you can use to control the game. The level of difficulty to pull it off is just lower. If you have people that you can trust, people that you can bring with you to operate with you. The thing that really strikes a chord with me about this floating concept, the idea that it was used as an insult that we've tried so hard to turn into something to be proud of, is that it really feels so alike to being a fan of this show in the first place. I'm willing to bet that most people listening to this have had a moment in their lives where they've hesitated even just a second before explaining to somebody that they really like the show Big Brother. Or maybe you've hesitated before saying that you like playing in online reality games. Because to most of the rest of the world, being a fan of reality TV is an insult. But what we have done is we have taken that and we have taken ownership of it. And we have said, you know what? We do like this. We do like this game. There are things to criticize about the show, sure, but we like this game and we're proud of it. In the same way that June is proud of her game, in the same way that Andy is proud of his game. And maybe you don't like those people. Maybe you don't like their games, but there's something here that I think everyone can relate to. And I think in a small way, this is part of why floating has remained such a controversial and present concept on Big Brother. So hopefully that's something we can all be proud of. And that's what I have for you this week. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope this was informative in some way, maybe interesting in another. I don't expect this podcast to revolutionize the discussion on floating or change the misuse of it. Of course it's not. But for anybody that listens, I hope that you have found some kind of insight here. I know that in my research, I was really fascinated with the results of what I found, both in terms of the terminology and in terms of the usage of the strategy and how it developed and really the key elements that that Andy used and succeeded with. Something that I do want to talk about eventually is how floating as an individual strategy can be used by people who are not able to create groups in the game. Meaning sometimes outcast minorities, people that don't have the natural advantage of being able to just grab a bunch of people or be included with a bunch of people and work within these big groups. individual floaters can work around those. And as we've talked about, that is a difficult thing to do. It's one of the reasons why this individual floating thing can be so hard to pull off. But it's one of the better tools to use as somebody that is not naturally included. That ties into a podcast that I would like to do about playing the game as an outcast or somebody that doesn't fit in, which hopefully includes many different kinds of players. But this individual floating stuff is definitely a key element to all of that. But thank you so much for joining me this time. You can find me on Twitter if you want to talk more with me at Armstrong Terran, or really if you want to chat with me. I do all kinds of Big Brother discussion on my Twitch channel, twitch.tv/Terran Armstrong. I have streams sometimes where you can just come and ask me questions and we can chat through anything, including floaters. So you can find me there. You can give me a follow. I would very much appreciate it. And I'll see you next time.
Grand Canyon University, an affordable private Christian university, is one of the largest and fastest growing universities in the country, offering more than 270 programs online. In addition to federal grants and aid, GCU's online students received nearly $130 million in institutional scholarships in 2022. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu/myoffer to see the scholarships you may qualify for.